because there were only three lectures last week, we have waited until the second week of the course to do honest to goodness cosmology. Hopefully we'll embark on that today. So I did just want to, for the most part, the idea with so the lecture notes for lectures 3 and 4, where we missed lecture 4 on Friday. They go through these three sorts of spaces, the maximally symmetric spaces, the FRW spaces, and the black hole spacetimes. So these guys we had a chance to cover most of that material in lecture 3. And I just want to wrap up a couple of things here. And here also, I just want to say a few words just to make sure that on both of these, the main thing I want to make sure is that you know what the key formulas are in both of these sections. There's like, both of these sections, there's really one key formula here and two key formulas here that you should remember for the rest of your life. You'll never regret knowing them. They're really helpful and beautiful. I also just want to make sure that, so in the homework, you're going to go through these two sections in detail on your own, or maybe you already have. But for those of you who have not, I just want to make sure that you don't do, if you're not careful about it, you should be efficient about the algebra, or else these could be gross to work out on the homework. But if you do it right, they shouldn't be gross. Like if you're doing the homework this week and one of the problems seems like it's taking more than a page of algebra, that means there's a better way to do it. So I just want to sort of sketch what the better way to do it is. So just be careful to try to do the work efficiently on here. And then here, for the sake of time, I don't think I'm really going to have much more to say about black holes. Fortunately, you had a little bit of an opportunity to meet the, at least a taste of the metrics in the Thursday tutorial last week. I'll just have a few words to say about that, but then I really want to get on to getting to know the FRW metric in more detail today and tomorrow to really get into actual honest-to-goodness physical cosmology. Before I plunge in, I thought today instead of a joke, I would give you a riddle. Okay, so see who is awake enough to get this one. Let's see. What has six eyes, two noses, and three mouths? Nobody? The answer is a monster. Okay. Next time I will bring an easier one. Okay. You know what really hurts about this is that that's like the first joke you guys laughed at, and it's the first non-Russian joke. Although I did learn it from a Russian person, but it's not the same. Anyway, okay. So just to finish up this lecture, because just to finish up sort of the covering the most important space times about the maximally symmetric spaces. So we already saw there's this sort of beautiful single construction that gets you the metric for a maximally symmetric spacetime, for any of the maximally symmetric spacetimes with any signature, any number of time dimensions, any number of space dimensions, and any positive, negative, or zero curvature. And just to recap, we take an embedding of the manifold that we want, the n-dimensional manifold that we want, in a flat n plus one dimensional embedding space. The embedding space has some metric on it that has the first n-dimensional part of it has the signature that we're ultimately hoping to get. And then we add one more coordinate whose contribution to the signature is determined by the curvature that we ultimately want to get. And then we embed the space by giving a quadratic equation that's exactly modeled on this formula. So we replace this side by k rho squared, and this side is the same except every dx becomes an x. Uh, Okay, and now we want to get this formula written as an n-dimensional metric instead of an n plus 1 dimensional one. So we just solve for x n plus 1, take the differential of that formula, use it to eliminate dx n plus 1 here, and we get a nice simple expression, the general maximally symmetric metric in sort of quasi-Cartesian coordinates, if you want. And another important thing is that we said this construction was also very helpful for visualizing what the spaces are like. And so I briefly sketched on the board, how all of the spaces can be viewed as hyperboloids or hourglasses or balls. I recommend doing that for yourself if you haven't had a chance, just to make sure you have, it's the most natural way to get an intuitive picture of these spaces. An actual intuitive geometric picture of these spaces is to view them as just like you think of the sphere, as embedded in a higher dimensional flat space.
Yep. Quasi-Cartesian?
Quasi-Cartesian meaning that I started with n plus 1 Cartesian coordinates on this space. So in other words, when you have a space that has a flat metric, you can find some coordinates in which the metric looks like is just diagonal and has some pluses and some minuses. Those are what I mean by Cartesian coordinates, the coordinates in which the metric looks like that. So the normal, so in Minkowski space, Cartesian coordinates I would call x, y, t. And so those are what I mean by Cartesian coordinates. And so here, the reason I'm calling these guys quasi-Cartesian coordinates is just because, I had n plus 1 genuinely Cartesian coordinates in the embedding space. Now I eliminated one. Okay, so I had so it's like in the case of the sphere. That was a terrible sphere. In the case of the sphere, I take the embedding space. I can think of the embedding space as having Cartesian coordinates x, y, and z. But then the construction that I did here amounted to now lifting those x and y, throwing away the z coordinate, eliminating the z coordinate, and lifting the x and y coordinates so that they basically, you can now think of them as actually living on the two space that I'm trying to describe. So now imagine jettisoning the three space, forgetting it was ever there, forget about the embedding space. That was just a fiction that was convenient for constructing things. Now you really just have this two space. It doesn't seem quite fair to call the coordinates that are covering it Cartesian coordinates, but they're inherited from, they ultimately were originally in the Cartesian coordinates in the embedding space. So I just call them quasi-Cartesian. I'm not sure there's a more formal definition than that. Also, they look like Cartesian coordinates. They're like x, y, and z, as opposed to having names like theta and phi, and that's really what I mean. If there's one, in this section, in the tutorial last week, you hopefully had a chance to check the formula for. So this is now the metric that we were after, and then there's a formula for the inverse metric, which is similar. So hopefully you had a chance to just check that if you multiply, if you contract, so to check that this is really the inverse of that, you just contract GAB with GBC and check that they really multiply to delta AC, the identity matrix. That's the definition of the inverse. And then if the inverse exists, it's unique. So once you've checked that this works, you know that that's the right answer. That's the unique answer. So let's just, for a moment, just to make sure, let's just do this as an example of making sure that we're doing the calculations efficiently. I just want to make sure that we're all on the same page about checking that this is the inverse of this, what would that look like? So again, I want to take GAB, GBC. I want to check that that is equal to delta AC. Okay, so GAB is A to AB. I'm just gonna do this one sample calculation just to make sure everybody's on the same page about how to do it. And then GBC would be A to BC plus K XB XC over rho minus K X squared. Okay, so now I'm going to expand it out and get four cross terms. The first cross term, the first term is exactly the one that I want. When A to AB hits A to BC, well, A to AB is precisely defined as the inverse of A to with its index. A to with its indices up is defined to be the inverse of A to with its indices down. So there, that first term, I know what I'm going to get. Then I get this cross term from these two guys multiplying. So all that happens here is this A to BC lowers the index on this x. So I have xA, xC over rho squared. And I get this cross term. So this A to AB raises the index on this xB. So I just get plus k xA, xC over rho squared minus kx squared. And then finally, I get a term where these two guys multiply each other. So that's minus k squared. XA, XC, this XB hits that XB and just becomes an X squared. So this becomes K, X squared, XA, XC over rho squared minus K, X squared. Okay, now it's a simple matter to check that if you just take these three terms and put them all over this common denominator, rho squared times rho squared minus KX squared. So you have to multiply this term by rho squared over rho squared. You have to multiply this guy by rho squared minus kx squared over rho squared minus kx squared. You'll just see they just cancel against each other. Okay? So all the calculations should be roughly that length. Okay? So each step. So if anything is getting much hairier than that, just step back. So in particular, it's very useful. I mentioned this in the notes, but you know it's important to use this notation. It's very useful to use this raising and lowering notation where xA is equal to A to AB, PQ, XB, and then whenever you have XA, XA, that's just X squared, and whenever you take the derivative of a guy with an index up, that's just delta AB, and whenever you take the derivative of a guy with an index down, that's just A to AB, and what else? If you take the derivative of X squared, with respect to C, that's just 2xc. Okay, so anyway, just make sure to use those identities, and it should all be good. I'm not trying to make anyone suffer. Okay, so now what is the essential formula here? The most important result, the one you should really remember. Why wasn't that working? Sorry. What I want, okay. So the key formula to remember, I'm sorry, it's somehow me and the, we're not on the same wavelength, me and this board today. But this formula is really worth remembering. So you go through checking the formulae, and at some point you actually get an expression for the Riemann curvature, and when you lower this index, it takes this beautiful form that is characteristic of all maximally symmetric spaces, and that no longer up until then we had been using a particular coordinate system, but at this point you get a formula that doesn't depend on the coordinates; it's explicitly covariant, and so this formula is now true in any coordinate system, and it's the thing you really should remember it's sort of the, if you're going to remember one formula about maximally symmetric spaces, that is the one non-trivial formula that lets you figure out everything about the geometry of those spaces as fast as possible, and is very memorable, it's this one. Okay, it's that it's k, the sine of the curvature, over the curvature radius squared, and then just times gac gbd minus gad gbc, this sort of combination where you take this guy and this guy, and minus this guy and this guy. Okay, so that's really the point of that guy. You should, that's worth deriving once in your life and then remembering forever, never deriving again. Okay, so then there's a similar story with F or W. Okay, so the Friedman-Robertson-Walker spacetimes, what are they? Well, the picture is that an F or W spacetime is a spacetime where if you freeze time and explore the geometry along some spatial surface, it's exactly one of these maximally symmetric spaces with all space directions and no time direction. But then there's no particular symmetry in the time direction. That geometry can stretch or shrink in an arbitrary way. And exactly how it will stretch and shrink will depend on what matter is present in the spacetime. Okay, so in other words, that's what this metric is saying. There's a time direction, and then there's a spatial part of the metric. The spatial part of the metric is just what we were previously calling GPQ K AB DXA DXB. Okay, except again, what we're going to now take is we're now going to consider n plus one dimensional FRW spacetime. So n space directions, one time direction. Of course, our actual universe that we observe appears to be 3 plus 1. Okay, so this is going to be a purely spatial metric with n space directions. So this is gn 0 k. So if we just take our formula for what this guy is and expand it out, we would say, okay, and then this function a of t, that's multiplying in front, the square of a of t appears here. A of t is called the scale factor, because if a of t grows by a factor of 2, it just says that all the points in this manifold have gotten a factor of 2 more distant from one another. Or if it shrinks by a factor of 2, it's saying the physical spatial distance between two points on this spatial slice have gotten a factor of 2 closer to one another. Okay, now just a technical point that's useful to know when you go to read any textbook on cosmology is that, so if we just take our metric that we derived previously and plug it in here, it would have a row in it. Okay, so in other words, there's sort of two different objects appearing here. It looks like when we just plug in our formula that there's one scale row, and then there's this other time-dependent scale a of t. And the first point is just those are not independent. We can just always, without loss of generality, by a change of coordinates, set row as equal to 1. Okay, so we just do that as follows. So imagine that I just made the replacement here, xa is equal to row x twiddle a, and then I made the replacement that a is equal to a twiddle rho. And I remove x and a in favor of x twiddle and a twiddle. And if you just imagine plugging those things in, you'll see that what happens here is that it becomes the new variable a twiddle of t delta AB plus K X twiddle A X twiddle B over 1 minus K kx twiddle squared. And so henceforth, I will just imagine that I've made the coordinate transformation into these natural set of coordinates, and I'll drop the twiddles. Okay, and assume that rho in these formulas is always equal to 1. So in the lecture notes for lectures 3 and 4, the main thing that you're checking on your homework this week, and the main thing that I want to get across here is that just as you went through and calculated with the maximally symmetric metrics for the purpose of getting this sort of one key equation, for the FRW metrics, you're going to calculate to get two key equations, the two key equations that describe the dynamics of the coupling between the geometry and the matter in a Friedman-Robertson-Walker universe. Okay, and so those are the Friedman equation . Okay, and in these lecture notes I've kept n arbitrary, even though our actual universe has n equals 3, because it's really no extra algebra, and you'll find that it's useful. You'll find that there'll be plenty of occasions in your life where you either want to hypothesize that there might be that at some epoch the universe might have a different number of spatial dimensions, different number of large spatial dimensions than it does today, or you just want to compare. It'll just be of interest to compare the behavior of the, you want to know what is special about our three-dimensional universe. Is some property of our universe special? And you might to check that, ask what the calculation would have looked like in a different spatial dimension. Anyway, there's no additional algebra in keeping it general here. So in this lecture, I keep the n in there instead of 3. But anyway, so this is the so-called Friedman equation. It comes from the G00 component of Einstein's equations. And then there's the other important equation, which is the continuity equation. Okay, so these are the key things to take away here. These are the things you should derive once in your life. You will derive them once in your life this week on the problem set. So what are they saying? Okay, so first of all, I've forgotten to tell you what this h is. So h is another function of time. Okay, h is another function of time, and it is nothing but the derivative of the scale factor with respect to time, dA dt over A. Or in other words, A dot over A. So this is in common cosmology notation, an over dot, A dot, is defined to be time derivative, dA dt. Okay, so what is this equation saying? So if h is bigger, the universe is in some sense expanding faster. Okay, another way to write this is just d the log of A dt. Okay, so larger, when at a moment when h of t is larger, that's saying that the slope of log A is bigger. Okay, so this equation, what is it saying? It's saying, well, how fast the universe expands, how big h squared is, depends on the following things. If there's more energy density present in the universe at a given time, and according to this, the universe expands faster. If the cosmological constant lambda is bigger, then the universe expands faster. And here we have a minus sign. If k is plus 1, if the universe is if the spatial part of the universe is positively curved, if it's a sphere, the universe expands a little bit more slowly for a given amount of it. For a given amount of energy density and cosmological constant, the universe expands more slowly. If it's negatively curved, it expands a little bit more quickly. Yeah?
Why would greater energy density push on to faster expansion than greater attraction?
That's a good question. I mean, that's sort of a counterintuitive. Both of those things are ultimately derivable from Einstein's equations, but you derive those two things in two different limits. I mean, so both of those things that you say, they sound contradictory, but they're not. They're both true. So it's first of all true that if you solve Einstein's equations, both of them follow from Einstein's equations. The first thing is this thing that you'll derive on the problem set, which is that if you increase the energy density, if you assume that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic, so it's described by an FRW metric, and you plug in larger rho, the expansion is faster. If you want the interpretation that we will give, let me come back to trying to give a more intuitive explanation of what's going on there. I'll say something in a moment about this equation. But then on the other hand, the other result that you have in mind, the thing that we're familiar with from Newtonian gravity, that also follows from Einstein's equations, but in a different context. There you're not plugging in the FRW metric, you're plugging in the metric around a static source located at a particular point in space. So it's not homogeneous like the FRW metric is. And you're working in the Newtonian limit. So you're working in the limit where the metric is a small perturbation from flat space and the velocities are small. So relative to the speed of light. So, the simplest thing to say is that although they sound intuitively like different things, there's no contradiction between them, because ultimately they're two derivations in two different contexts. That said, it would be nice to have, a nice physical picture of why this is the case. So for that, maybe it will help a little bit to say what. So then, what does this equation say? So this equation says, how does the geometry, how does the scale factor that determines the distances in this metric, spatial distances, how does it respond to the various matter elements that are present? The energy density, the cosmological constant, which, as we'll see later, is kind of indistinguishable from a vacuum, from the energy density of the vacuum, and the spatial curvature. But then this guy characterizes the inverse relationship. As the universe expands, so when h is non-zero, if h is positive, the universe is expanding. Because of this minus sign, rho dot is negative. Okay, so assuming that the sum of the energy density and pressure in the universe, under normal circumstances, these guys are both positive quantities. Assuming this guy is positive, this equation says that when h is positive, when the universe is expanding, the corresponding energy density of the universe is diluting. The energy per unit volume is going down. So that we will see in the next lecture has the interpretation as, so on the problem set, you can derive this guy in two different ways. One way is to just take, this is really the GII component of Einstein's equations. This guy was the 0-0 component. This is the II component. And you just, if you write that down, the II component directly, it's just a little bit gross, although it's perfectly correct as a complement to this equation. But you can just simplify it by using, you can use G00 and the time derivative of the G00 equation to simplify this guy into this form. But there's also a more direct physical meaning of and a direct derivation of this guy that, that more reflects its physical meaning. And that that is that the stress energy tensor in the universe is conserved. So it's a this equation is the conservation of stress energy. It's implied by Einstein's equations, and the fact that I didn't actually introduce the Bianchi identities back when we were I bet this was already introduced in your GR course. The fact that the stress energy tensor has to be conserved in general relativity, conserved in this sense, it has to satisfy this equation to be consistent with the fact that on the right hand side, the Bianchi identities demand that G mu nu is equal to zero. But okay, so that this is four equations. The mu equals zero component of this just gives you this this equation directly. And this is saying something like, so rho dot, let's now go to the familiar case, the actual universe where n is equal to 3 here. And let's deal with this situation where the pressure is negligible. So we just have a pressureless gas. Okay, then in that case, remember H is A dot over A. So let's just divide rho onto this side to separate rhos and A's. So this is rho dot over rho is equal to minus 3 A dot over A. Well, I can integrate that differential equation. That just says that rho is proportional to A to the minus 3. And so this is saying the familiar fact that if as the scale factor grows here, the distances between all particles are growing in proportion to A. Okay, so if these particles are riding along at fixed x coordinates, as A increases, the physical distance between them stretches by a factor of A. So if I have a three-dimensional universe, the volume stretches by a factor of A cubed. And it's what you naturally expect that if the volume grows in proportion to A to the minus 3 and the number and the number of particles is conserved, that the energy density should fall by a factor of A to the minus 3. Yeah. So pressureless gas, well, so like the gas in this room, if you want to get pressure and the gas in this room is an example of a pressureless gas. Okay, now I know it is true that the gas in this room has pressure, but from the standpoint of general relativity, the pressure, when you add the appropriate factors of C squared to make it have the same units as the energy density, the energy density in this room is so huge relative to the pressure times, let's see, what do I need to add? So rho. I want this guy times. This is energy per unit volume. Energy is force times length over volume. This guy is force per unit Sorry? Oh, I'm sorry. These guys already have the same dimension, don't they? Energy per unit volume, and sorry about that. They already have the same dimensions. So if you write them both, if you put them in the same units, the pressure of the gas in this room compared to its energy density, where its energy density includes its rest mass energy density. Like normally in the room, when you're doing thermodynamics with the gas in this room, you're thinking about the interplay of the pressure and like the thermal energy of the particles, their kinetic energies. But their kinetic energies are, so those things might be comparable, but their kinetic energies are stupendously small relative to the rest mass energies of each atom. So, but those things gravitate, the rest mass energy also gravitates in addition to the thermal energy. So when you include the rest mass energy, it is so big relative to the pressure for a normal non-relativistic gas that that is negligible in terms of sourcing gravity. We'll see that when we get to relativistic gases, like a gas of photons, then they become comparable. Then we'll derive later that P is equal to 1/3 rho. So a normal non-relativistic matter, or like we'll see that the galaxies in the universe actually are very well modeled by a gas where every galaxy is a particle whose mass is equal to the mass of that galaxy, and they're moving around very non-relativistically in the universe today, and they essentially just have energy density and no pressure. Okay, let's see. I think the one thing I had intended to tread briefly over this lecture and try to get on to the next one. But I do just want to say one more thing about these spacetimes, which is just it's important to get in your head the fact that, you know, what are the symmetries that characterize each of the spacetimes? Okay, so in Minkowski space is an example of a maximally symmetric spacetime. Okay, so let's talk about 3+1-dimensional Minkowski space. If I lay down coordinates, if I'm sitting here at the origin, and I lay down coordinates everywhere in Minkowski space, and I say, aha, I've surveyed the geometry of my universe, and then another person who is translated in time or in space relative to me sets up coordinates around his position, writes out the geometry of space, we won't be able to tell that we're in different positions. So there's a symmetry under the four different space and time translations. But then, alternatively, if another person was rotated relative to me, describe their geometry, we wouldn't be able to tell the difference between our two orientations. So there's +3 rotations. And then furthermore, if someone is flying by relative to me, and they set up so a boosted observer flies by relative to me, again, that's a symmetry of Minkowski space, as we know from special relativity. They also describe the same geometry. So there's 10 total symmetries in Minkowski space, 4 translations, boosts, and rotations. So when we go to, and that turns out to be the same number. There's a paragraph in the notes. I won't describe this now, but there's a paragraph in the notes for lectures 3 and 4 that describes how you can convince yourself that that's the same thing for if instead you took 4-dimensional De Sitter space or anti-De Sitter space. They all have this same number of symmetries, 10. But now, when we go to Friedman-Robertson-Walker spacetime, now the symmetry is only in the spatial direction. So it's still true that if this is a spatial slice of my spacetime, if I set up my coordinates here, if I survey the geometries around me here, or if another observer over here surveys the geometry around them, they'll see the same thing. So there's 3 spatial translations worth of symmetry. Every point at a fixed moment in time, every spatial point in the spacetime is equivalent. And there's still 3 rotational symmetries. If I rotate my axes at a fixed time and re-describe the geometry, it'll look exactly the same. But that's it, okay? It's no longer the case. There's no longer any symmetry under time translation. The universe, an FRW universe, changes in time. It stretches and squeezes. And the universe that we look out at does not show any symmetry in time. All observations show us that it's changed tremendously over time. So you kill one of these guys. You kill, the time translation gets taken away. And then the three boosts get taken away. There's some particular reference frame in which, if I freeze time in that reference frame, the spatial slice, every point is the same along the spatial slice. The spatial slice is one of these maximally symmetric metrics. But if another person went flying by and took a spatial slice appropriate to, a person flying by would have some spatial slice that was tilted relative to the preferred maximally symmetric spatial slice, that moving observer would not see the same geometry that I do. They would see a universe that was, according to the sort of canonical observer. This moving observer would see a universe where, in one direction, the galaxies looked closer together, and in the other direction, galaxies looked further apart. Because in this direction, they would be looking back in time, according to me, and in this direction, they would be looking forward in time, according to me. Okay, so an FRW universe. At a given moment, every point on that spatial slice is the same, and every way you can orient yourself is the same. So the fact that every point is the same, people use the words, the space is, it is spatially homogeneous. Okay, so the universe looks the same, at least statistically speaking, to me, and to another observer in a distant galaxy who's also observing the universe today, 14 billion years after the Big Bang. So that's spatial homogeneity. And then these three guys, the fact that if I observe the universe and another person comes along and has their whole lab oriented this way, but they also observe the universe, that statistically speaking, the universe looks the same to both of us. That is called spatial isotropy. Okay. So the FRW universes are homogeneous, spatially homogeneous, and spatially isotropic spacetimes. But there's no boost invariance. There's no time translation invariance. There's a preferred spatial slice, preferred spatial way to slice up the spacetime so that the spatial slices are maximally symmetric, yeah?
Can you say that this universe is compact, but it has no boundary?
Universe, when it's closed, okay, yeah.
When k is one.
When k is plus one, that's right. When k is plus one, that's a good point. I should say that. That's a very good point. So one thing I forgot to mention is that when k is equal to plus 1 in an FRW universe, that's the case where the spatial surfaces are the three-dimensional maximally symmetric surfaces of positive curvature. In other words, the three-sphere. And you say that this is a quote-unquote closed universe. When k is equal to minus 1, the spatial slices are the three-dimensional maximally symmetric spaces of negative curvature. In other words, the three-dimensional hyperboloids. And these are so-called open universes. And finally, or spatially closed and spatially open, you'll sometimes hear people say. And then when k is equal to 0, the spatial slices are just ordinary, flat, three-dimensional Euclidean space. So you'll hear people say flat universes. Now here there's a really worry of confusion. You should really be careful to understand that this means that they are spatially flat. At a given moment in time, if you survey the three-dimensional spatial geometry of the universe, it is flat Euclidean space. But the space-time, the four-dimensional space-time, is not flat. It has curvature proportional to h.
It's actually also open, right? Only for k plus 1 is...
You usually don't refer to this guy as open, although it is. These guys are both spatially infinite. These guys both go on forever, whereas this guy is closed up as a sphere. This guy is compact, and these guys are non-compact.
And for our universe, what is the value of lambda and k?
That's a good question. So as far as, so it's one of the, you know, key observations about the universe today that to the best that we can observe, which as I'll explain later, is about plus or minus, to an accuracy of about plus or minus 1%, our universe today is consistent with being flat. It could be slightly open or slightly closed, and the error bars are just not good enough to detect that. We don't know, but we don't have any evidence at the moment that it's open or closed. It's consistent with flat, and that in fact is the so-called flatness puzzle. There's a reason to be puzzled about that, which I'll explain. Hopefully, I'll get to that in the next lecture, and that's one of the claimed successes of the theory of inflation, is that it's supposed to give an explanation for why, even at this late time in the universe's evolution, it's so close to being flat. But so the easiest guy to picture here is the closed universe. So I'm going to draw a two-sphere, and you can imagine a two-sphere. Really, the spatial surfaces are three spheres. But the physical picture of the universe here is that an observer sitting at a constant x, one of those x-coordinates, the FRW x-coordinate, the spatial coordinates x, those are the so-called co-moving coordinates. They're just fixed points on the three-sphere. Okay. But the physical distance, according to that metric, if I freeze the universe at some moment in time and ask for what is the physical distance between these two coordinates, it's the co-moving distance, the distance that would be evaluated with respect to that maximally symmetric metric that I wrote GAB with superscript N0K. It's the distance that I would evaluate with that metric, but times A of t. Okay, so you say the physical distance, the actual distance, the spatial distance evaluated with respect to the full metric between these two points is equal to A of t times the co-moving distance. So R sub c is the co-moving distance, spatial distance, R sub p is the physical distance. And so as the universe grows by a factor of, as the scale factor, if it grows between now and 10 billion years from now by a factor of 2, the picture is that two galaxies that, as we'll see hopefully before the end of this lecture in a few moments, two galaxies that ride along at constant co-moving distances, at constant, they just ride along at fixed positions on the three sphere. But the idea is that as A of t grows by a factor of 2, you can think of the whole three sphere as having its radius inflated by a factor of 2. It's like a balloon that it's like we have a spherical balloon, and the galaxies are, we took a marker and we drew dots on the rubber. And then the universe growing just corresponds to blowing in the balloon, inflating it by a factor of whatever, by a factor of 2. When you do that, you'll find that the physical distance across the rubber between one dot and the next has increased by a factor of 2. Okay, and these coordinates, the coordinates that are fixed on the balloon, in other words, the x, the spatial coordinates that I've called x up there, those are the so-called co-moving coordinates. And the observers who move along, who just sit at those, we'll see that it's a geodesic of the space-time. It's a physical trajectory to just sit, a massive particle or a galaxy or you or me. We tend to just sit at these fixed spatial coordinates, and we are to a good approximation so-called co-moving observers of the universe. Okay. So before we leave, just for reference, the two remaining guys, the two black hole metrics, No, those are supposed to represent, those are more like the situations that we were talking about before, the situations that you're, the metrics that you're familiar with from Newtonian gravity. There's a gravitating mass at the center at some spatial point in the space-time. Okay, so it's sitting there and warping the space-time around it. I guess the only thing I want to say is that if the mass is just sitting there, so if you have a gravitational collapse to a black hole, a gravitational collapse that is so intense that none of the material forces of the matter that's collapsing can manage to hold itself up, like the Earth manages to hold itself up against its own gravity, but if you tried to make the Earth too dense, it would fail to do that and it would collapse to a black hole. What does it settle down to? There's some very violent collapse, but at the end of the day, it rings down to some quiescent state. So, and that comes in one of two varieties. If the final thing is just sitting there and not spinning, that's the so-called Schwarzschild black hole. Okay, the special case where it's not spinning. So what are the symmetries in that case? Well, in that case, there is time translation symmetry, and there's also rotational symmetry. So there's the space-time, once it's settled down, it looks the same at any different moment in time. And then there's also full three-dimensional rotational symmetry. It's isotropic, but not around any point, like the FRW space-time is. It's only isotropic around the center, around the black hole of the center. So it has these four symmetries. And then a spinning black hole, if the mass at the center is spinning, that's the so-called Kerr metric. And there, you really just have a time translation symmetry and then only one additional symmetry. It's no longer, there's a symmetry if you rotate around the spin axis by some arbitrary angle. You can't tell you've done it. So that's the least symmetric guy, but as I mentioned before, physically, this is really a tremendously important one. It's sort of the endpoint of a general gravitational collapse to a black hole. No matter how gross the collapse is, at the end of the day, all the grossness gets radiated away as gravitational waves, and what you're left with is this metric, the Kerr metric. So physically, it's very important. But also, as a matter of luck, it turns out to be stupendously beautiful. It has all of these special properties that if you want, it has all of these special mathematical properties that, I mean, one way to say it is they're kind of surprising. It has more beauty than you would expect based on how much symmetry it has. You know, often special properties are a consequence of the explicit symmetries of a metric. The Kerr metric basically violates that. It has more than its fair share of nice properties, basically. So it's beautiful. That's all I have to say. I think maybe the one other thing to say, just one thing that might be helpful to know at some point in the future. Here, there's really two different coordinate systems that are in common usage. One of those are the so-called Boyer-Lindquist coordinates, and these are kind of the coordinates that, if you're going to do an astrophysical problem, if you're going to actually calculate, you know, what does the accretion disk around this black hole look like? What does radiation from this black hole look like to a distant telescope? You're probably going to use Boyer-Lindquist coordinates. They look like spherical coordinates, so there's just like time and radius and the theta direction and the phi direction, just like ordinary spherical coordinate description of Minkowski space. These guys reduce to the standard Schwarzschild coordinates that you undoubtedly met in your GR class, the usual ones that are used to describe the Schwarzschild metric. But there's another set of coordinates called Kerr-Schild coordinates, the ones that are more like coordinates that Kerr originally found when he found the metric. I just want to say that if you look at the metric written in this form in Boyer-Lindquist coordinates, you will not believe me when I tell you that it's a beautiful metric. It looks disgusting in these coordinates. If you want to see the structure of the spacetime, what are the various special properties it has? Those come out much more clearly in these Kerr-Schild coordinates. I won't write those on the board right now or explain much about them, but there's a little bit about them in the notes. I think that's all I really have time to mention. So I just have a couple of minutes now. And I wanted to use those couple of minutes to just do the first section of lecture notes. So on the wiki, there's a new set of lecture notes for lectures 5 and 6. And those are what I'll be, those are the ideas to cover those today and tomorrow. It's actually only about one lecture's worth of notes, so we should be able to cover this tomorrow. But maybe I'll just tell you just, Is it a mistake to start a new section right now with like 2 minutes left? It could be a mistake. But could I, okay. Let's say hypothetically the section took 5 minutes to cover and blew your mind. It's not, that's the thing. It's, this section is not going to blow your mind, but it's a precursor to the subsequent sections that are going to blow your mind. So what do you think? 5 minutes according to my estimate now, which really means it's going to take me like 8 minutes, or should we just leave it until the next lecture? Who wants to leave it until the next lecture? Okay, and now who? That's a pretty good showing. That's like the biggest showing of hands that I've gotten so far in this class. So who wants to do it now? Okay, I'm just going to do it really fast right now. It is a democratic process after all. Or at least that's how I set it up there. So I just wanted to introduce you to the the standard coordinates. We derived the FRW these maximally symmetric metrics and the FRW metrics in these quasi-Cartesian coordinates, because it gave a nice unified way to look at everything at once and derive some simple formulas about some of the key formulas simply. But those are not the coordinates you'll meet in textbooks. So I just want to quickly introduce you to the coordinates you'll meet in textbooks so that then actually next time we can get going with discussing the basic physics. The basic physics being what are the kinematics? So if you have actual particles moving through these spacetimes, massive particles like galaxies or you in your rocket ship, or massless particles like photons, how do they behave? And related to this, what are the horizons like? So just like black holes have horizons, cosmological spacetimes have horizons that are very crucial to understanding them. And then the dynamics. We saw the dynamical equations were the Friedman equation and the continuity equation up there. We're just going to basically solve those equations and see for the most simplest and most important cases how the geometry responds to the matter, how the matter responds to the evolution of the geometry. So, but as a preparation for that, again, what I just want to show you quickly are what are the basic coordinates that you need to be familiar with. The coordinates, they have standard letters that they're called. And I'll describe what they mean. I'm not sure, they're not like named after a person or something like that. I don't think. Here's what I wanted to say. So let's now specialize to the case of three plus one dimensions, three spatial dimensions like our actual universe. So in our quasi-Cartesian coordinates, we were writing the metric. Remember, we could set rho as equal to 1. So we were writing the metric like this. Okay. The first set of coordinates is obtained by just switching from the quasi-Cartesian coordinates to spherical coordinates in the way you would expect. Okay, so you just take x1, x2, x3, the three Cartesian coordinates, spatial coordinates, to be equal to their normal formulae in terms of spherical coordinates. So r sine theta cosine phi sine theta sine phi and cosine theta. So if you do that, this metric assumes one of its standard forms, minus dt squared plus a squared of t And then the inside here becomes dr squared over 1 minus kr squared plus r squared d omega squared. That's a good thing to check. Again, once in your life, probably we'll do that on the tutorial. Okay, so now let's, again, it's easiest to visualize in the case where k is equal to plus 1 and we're talking about the 3 sphere. So this is the 3 sphere that we live on. We've taken it to have radius 1. This is the radius rho. We've scaled the coordinates so that rho is equal to 1. And now you're sitting at the origin in this space and you're looking out. And when you look out a distance r in these coordinates, so if you look out to this point on the manifold, if you look out at a galaxy over here and it's a distance r away from you, geometrically in this formulation, what r is it's this distance right here. Okay, but you might want to change to a definition of r. It's another, the other convenient possibility, the other conventional thing to do that's useful for various purposes we'll see, is to switch to a coordinate that's actually sort of the actual coordinate along the sphere, which is usually called chi. Okay, and so the change of coordinates is just given by r is equal to this function s sub k of chi, where this is just depending on what k is. This is when k is equal to plus 1, this is sine of chi. When k is equal to 0, this is chi. And when k is equal to minus 1, this is sinh of chi. And when you make that coordinate transformation, again, something that you'll check in the tutorial, is this metric becomes, okay, we just changed the spatial metric, so now it looks like d chi squared plus this function s sub k of chi squared d omega squared, where d omega squared is the metric on the 2 sphere here, the usual metric on the 2 sphere. So those are the two standard choices for the radial coordinate, and they have exactly this meaning that r is like measuring the radius this way, chi is like measuring the radius away from you this way. And then the one other choice is that just like there are two possible choices for the radius, there's two canonical choices for the time. That time t there is called the proper time of, well, that is called sometimes called the cosmological time. It's the proper time as measured by a co-moving observer. If an observer sits at a fixed spatial coordinate and just measures how much time has elapsed on his clock, it's this time t. But another convenient thing is to change. If we notice that if we take dt is equal to the scale factor a times d eta, then this dt squared will become a squared d eta squared. And this is a squared times something. So the a squared just gets pulled out in front of the whole metric and becomes an overall conformal factor. So in other words, this metric will become a squared of t out in front times minus d eta squared plus dr squared over 1 minus kr squared plus r squared d omega squared. And this metric will become a squared okay, so I think that's maybe it for now. I just wanted to say, oh, and this guy eta, this t is usually called the cosmological time or the proper time of a co-moving observer. This eta is called the conformal time. It's very helpful for understanding. It's more helpful for understanding the causal structure of the space-time, the horizons, and so forth, as we'll see. And for various reasons it can be nicer. But that's it. There's two different choices for the radius, r and chi. There's two different choices for the time, t and eta. Yep, took 8 minutes after all. Thanks for listening. And so we'll pick up next time with, again, kinematics of particles in these space-times horizons and the dynamic and solving the dynamical equations. Okay?